You are listening to the Pronk Pop Show, presented by Raymond Thomas Pronk, the People's Paladin Pronk, propagating faith, family, friends, freedom first. Broadcasted by Renaissance Radio, Radiating Reason, and KDUX Web Radio. Podcasted by PronkPops.wordpress.com and KDUXWebRadio.wordpress.com. You are listening to KDUX Web Radio, broadcasting live from Richland College in Dallas, Texas, with a voice of Richland College. My name is Raymond Thomas Pronk, the presenter of the Pronk Pop Show. Views expressed on this show are my own, unless otherwise stated, and do not reflect the opinion of KDUX Web Radio, Richland College, or the Dallas County Community College District. Welcome to the Pronk Pop Show. What I want to do today is wrap up yesterday's show. I had to really cut it short because I had an appointment that I had to go to. I was a little late for it. And what I was talking about is, first, I started the show with the fact that there had been an attack and 129 people in Paris, France, were killed by a terrorist cell or group that was part of the Islamic State, or at least the Islamic State is claiming responsibility for it. It was a terrorist attack. And for those that are new to what's going on in the Middle East, I need to briefly, very briefly, who are the players? The Islamic State are Sunni Muslims, and the majority of Muslims in the world, there are 1.6 billion Muslims in the world, about 85 to 89%, you're going to get varying estimates, are Sunni. You have another 9 to 10% that are Shia, and you got about 1% or other. So the majority are Sunnis, but you have a lot of sects. Think of it, one way to think of it is there are a lot of Christians, but you have Catholics and Protestants, and within the Protestant faith, you have Methodists, Episcopalian, Lutheran, Baptist. So we look at them as all of them are Christian, and that's one way to think of Sunni. They're all fundamentally Muslim, but they're different sects. And the Islamic State are a very extreme, fanatical group. Many would say they're not even Islamic. However, they are. They're Salafists. They're militant Salafists. And that's an important distinction because you have Salafists that aren't militant. It's a fundamental, very conservative. They believe, the way they interpret and believe their religion is, think of it about 1,300 years ago when Muhammad was actually alive. They want to go back to that time, and they very much think we're in the end days, and they want to provoke a fight with the West, who they call as a group crusaders, getting back to the 11th and 12th centuries, where you had battles between crusaders, namely knights that went to the Middle East. Now, I'm not going to have a history lesson, but the first key point you have to understand is what is dividing people. The Islamic State is, like it says, it's Islamic. What is their goal? Their goal is to have a caliphate ruled by religious law, and their religion is Sharia. You need to have at least that basic understanding. Who are their main enemies? It might surprise you, but they call it the near enemy and the far enemy. The near enemy are those that do not believe in their version of Islam, in particular the Shia. And the Shia are predominantly in Iran, and the Iranians are Persians, and so it's a different ethnic group as well as a different religion. And then in Iraq, you have the majority are Shia, about two-thirds are Shia, but they're Arab. Now, the Islamic State uses terror to gain control, and as a result, people flee. That's why we have people fleeing both from Iraq and as well as Syria to the nations bordering on them, namely Turkey, Jordan, some went to Egypt, Lebanon, some Kurdistan, or the Kurds in Iraq control north, the north portion, the north east portion of Iraq, and there's oil there. And they're another ethnic group. So you have the Arabs, the Kurds, and the Persians in terms of ethnic groups. The Kurds are Sunni, majority of them are, but they're fighting both the Iraqi Shia as well as today the Islamic State. What you need to come to the conclusion is this is a mess. This is chaos. This is a very violent situation. The best way to characterize this is a religious, sectarian civil war. It's very violent, very brutal. And I emphasize the players. You first have to understand the players, and I'm not through listing the players. The American people have come to the conclusion that they do not want to send any more ground troops back to the Middle East. They're done. Been there, done that, didn't turn out too well. So we're not going to lose more American lives as well as treasure by trying to pick winners or losers or taking sides. That's where the American people are at. That does not mean that they don't want the Islamic State destroyed. I want it destroyed. The question is how you do it. The other complicating fact is this. You also, while you have a civil war raging or going back and forth in Iraq between the Islamic State and the Iraqi Shias, their military and militia there, you also have another civil war in Syria. And in Syria, you have the Assad regime, and they are predominantly Alawites. Think of them as Shia. And they're supported by Iran and Russia and China. And Iran's proxy is Hezbollah. That is an enemy of Israel, but also is predominantly what they're doing now is supporting the Assad regime in Syria. So I think I've listed the major players. The challenge is, what is the United States doing? What's its strategy? I think it's clear, if you listen to President Obama, he doesn't want to send troops back. He doesn't want to start another Iraqi war. And to a certain extent, I support him in that. And the reason is quite simply, politically, that is the right answer. It's not the right military answer, but it is the right answer. Now, in the United States, you have a group in Congress called the neoconservatives, also shorthand neocon. They're not new. They're not conservative. Most of them used to be in the Democratic Party. They're progressives. They're very much interventionist, both in the U.S. economy and abroad. They want to spread democracy throughout the world. They want to engage in nation building and have the United States be policemen of the world. There's a problem that the neocons have. The majority of the American people don't want that. And there's a second, even more important problem. We can't afford it anymore. In case they haven't looked, the national debt by the time Obama leaves office will be approaching or maybe even exceeding $20 trillion or $20,000 billion, where $1 billion is $1,000,000,000. Those are very big and for most people incomprehensible numbers. And what drives that national debt of the United States? War is a big contributor, but it's not the only contributor, and it's not the major contributor. It's the fact that the United States, for all of Obama's term in office, and the same with Bush, have run off massive deficits. Think of it this way. When we run a budgetary deficit, the government is spending more money than it's taking in terms of taxes. That's what a deficit is. So how does the U.S. federal government pay its bills? It has to issue debt. So its deficits are talked in terms of fiscal year deficit. And then they're now in the hundreds of billions of dollars. First 3 years of the Obama administration, they were $1.4 trillion, $1.3 trillion, $1.3 trillion. I'm rounding here. Where a trillion is $1,000 billion. Now, I always emphasize this because we do have the warmongers, the neocons, want to be policemen of the world and be engaged. Take sides, start wars. That's why I call them warmongers. They're interventionists. That's what they are. And they have been beating the drum. And the attack in France has picked up the drum beating. Because what the Islamic State is trying to do is provoke the United States and Europe to get them to come back to the Middle East, namely Syria and Iraq. In other words, they want a rematch or a replay of the previous Iraqi war. A little background about the Islamic State. They've had several name changes, but originally they were Al-Qaeda in Iraq that were largely, if not completely, defeated by U.S. forces in 2007 during the surge. Most of them were killed. Those that were captured were put in prison, and those few fortunate that were able to escape fled to Syria. Now their headquarters is in Raqqa in Syria, but they control a very large area of both far eastern Syria, as well as western Iraq, largely where the Sunnis are in both areas. And again, Sunnis are Arabs. Sunnis are the majority in terms of Muslim. But the victims of the Islamic State is anybody of any religion that doesn't agree with their version of Islam. And that's why if you're a Shia or Iraqi government official, they'll kill you on the spot. They don't take prisoners. For that matter, neither do the Iraqi militias. They don't take prisoners either. This is brutal, folks. They will torture you. I heard on the radio today of a story, and I believe it, that one, a child, was not compliant to what the Islamic State wanted, and they took a drill and drilled holes first in the kneecaps of this child, and then they drilled holes in the head. And the child is alive. I expected to be told he was dead, but it was alive, but he just was laying there. That is just a small, small example of what's going on. You can see the beheading videos, the videos on YouTube showing the execution by the Islamic State, where they line people up, have them kneel down, and they shoot them and either throw them in a ditch, in a mass grave, or throw them in a river. That is what happens when you have a religious sectarian civil war going on in your country. And that's why millions of people are fleeing. And the primary victims are Muslims, but also Christians and people of any other religion, Hindu, a few Jews. Everyone flees this kind of situation. There's no future. You might have been living there and your family might have been living for decades in one spot. But when you have religious fanatics, and that's what they are, controlling an area, what happens is people immediately, if they can, try to leave. And that's been going on for several years. Now, that's in Iraq. In Syria, the same thing has happened. And there's been over 300,000 dead there. The Assad regime is in power, and they are supported by Iran. And Iran uses their proxies, Hezbollah. So that's enough of a background to at least enable you to see who the players are. Now, the question is, what is the United States strategy? I think it's best described as semi-benign neglect. The commander-in-chief, President Obama, has made it very, very clear that he will not reintroduce large numbers of combat or infantry troops in either Syria or Iraq. The extent that we're involved today is special forces units that are primarily used for training and gathering intelligence and assisting our fighter pilots in locating and destroying various targets of the Islamic State. But it's limited. Who knows the exact number? About 5,000, maybe higher, probably higher, because you also have to consider that the CIA, the Central Intelligence Agency, does engage in covert operations, and most of the people that do that are former military. So we have quite a number of military and CIA in the area, both of Iraq and Syria. It's not a place to go on for vacation, obviously. And now what's getting everyone's attention is the fact that the Islamic State is deliberately and intentionally trying to provoke a fight, really a war, between the European nations as well as the United States. And again, they call that group of nations the Crusaders. Their other enemy is Israel. They want a fight. They want a war. And they will not limit their actions at all. And the challenge, and it's almost an impossible challenge, they will use, like they did in Paris, suicide bombers. People that are religious fanatics that will die for their cause, their jihad, their violent struggle against the infidels, the crusaders, the people that believe in a religion that they do not. This is very much a religious and ideological war, and what the Islamic State wants is a caliphate based on their religious beliefs that is Sunni, but that branch is Sunni Muslims that are Salafist, but violent or militant Salafist. And they go after anyone that does not follow their religious persuasion. And they're very repressive. So that, in a nutshell, is what we're up against. What is the United States to do? What is Europe to do? Now, yes, we have one reaction of France, is they have attacked several targets, probably with information from our own intelligence, the National Security Agency, as well as our Central Intelligence Agency, because you have to remember Syria and Iraq are large places. So you got to find out and know where the enemy is. The problem is you can't win a war by sporadic bombing or using drones. Oh, yes, you can, to some extent, contain the Islamic State, but you're never going to destroy them. You're never going to win the war. And that's the problem. What Barack Obama allegedly, and that's what he is at least telling us, his policy was one of containment. And just like before Benghazi, where the Democratic Party, including Obama, said that they've killed bin Laden, that's true, but they had al-Qaeda on the run. And on September 11, 2012, al-Qaeda, or affiliate of al-Qaeda, killed four Americans. Well, a week before this attack in Paris, Barack Obama said we've contained the Islamic State. Now, the government calls it ISIL, or ISIL, the Islamic State of Iraq and the Levant. That's the government's term. On television, they call it ISIS, the Islamic State of Iraq and Syria. This group calls themselves the Islamic State, or IS. Don't let that confuse you. So what's going to happen? What could happen? Any ideas? Well, I have an idea. Remember, one of the consequences of the civil wars, both in Iraq and Syria, is the fact we have, first, a lot of displaced persons, people fleeing their homes, either going to, if they're in Iraq, going to another city or place in Iraq, or fleeing the country and becoming refugees. The point is, the terror causes them to leave their homes for many years, usually with very little time or notice. And what they can take with them largely is what they can carry on their backs or in a cart, or if they're fortunate to have a car. And they're fleeing for their lives. And that's happening all over, and has been happening for years now, in Iraq and in Syria. Remember, the Islamic State was not established or declared until late June of 2014. And they were very, very successful initially because the Iraqi army, that is largely Shia, fled when the Islamic State attacked them. And they abandoned their equipment, ammunition, and most of that equipment and ammunition we left a lot behind. The United States Army, U.S. government, left a lot of resources behind for the Iraqis that were subsequently lost when they were attacked, and this is in northern Iraq and western Iraq, which is largely Sunni. So you need to know the ethnic background, the religious background, the history, to even understand or even have a grasp of what's going on here. It's like someone who's never seen a baseball game trying to understand what the rules are, what the positions are, who are their players. And what's in the backdrop is the United States has, over time, taken different sides and has had different goals. You see, the Obama administration wants to overthrow the Assad regime. That has been their objective now for several years. But 2 months ago, been several weeks now, Russia intervened on the side of Assad by sending over 50 military aircraft, as well as anti-aircraft missiles, to Assad. Why? Because the Russians want several, primarily naval bases in Syria. So they don't want to see the Assad regime fall. They're taking sides. And Iran, as I said earlier, are also taking sides. They are supporting Assad, again, on religious grounds primarily. In terms of Iran, remember, it's the Islamic Republic of Iran. And that is also a very repressive regime. It's a theocracy under Sharia law, but they are Shiites or Shia. Now, let's bring it back into the United States. And what is my creative idea? Given the fact that Europe today is being invaded by over a million refugees, mainly from Syria, but other countries as well, that are flooding into various countries. Some that simply don't want them. Some are welcoming them, such as Germany. Whether or not that will continue remains to be seen. One of the reasons they're being welcomed is you have in Italy, France, Germany, Spain, what's happening demographically, those countries are not reproducing their population. In other words, without immigration, their population will decline. So will Russia's, for that matter. You need a replacement birth rate of about 2.1%. Theirs is somewhere between 1 and under 2, depending on which country you're talking about. So they invite people to immigrate into their country. Otherwise, what will happen to all the European nations is the Germans, the French, the Spanish, the Russians, their population will decline. The only thing that's offsetting that is the fact that you have immigration, and a large portion of that immigration are Muslims that have a much higher birth rate, typically three births or more. The problem these nations have is the assimilation of Muslims into their nation. They tend to accumulate or gather in what used to be called ghettos, but neighborhoods, predominantly Muslim, where they simply do not want the police and firemen to come into their area because they're trying to rule it as an enclave under Sharia law. Now, what's happening is, even though the Muslims are a small but very rapidly growing in terms of numbers, they are still a small percentage or minority of the population. That will change radically in the next roughly 35 years. So a lot of your native Germans, French, Spaniards, Italians, Britons are finally waking up to the problem that this huge immigration of Muslims is fundamentally changing their country. Many would say it's really too late. I don't think it's ever too late, but I think you're going to see in Europe a backlash, as you are starting to see in the United States, because you have over 25 governors of the state, including Governor Abbott. I'm in Texas, that do not want any of these Syrian refugees to come to Texas, as well as the other state governors that have made clear their wishes. There's a problem with that. There's no really legal way to do that because the federal government is responsible for immigration and the enforcement of immigration law, but they're simply not doing it. The breaking news story is the fact that the House, under Speaker Paul Ryan, wants to hear from the Obama administration, first on their strategy in dealing with the Islamic State, but also on the refugee situation. You would think, but you would be wrong, that Saudi Arabia, which is a very large country, but not, I think the last time I checked, they had about 25, 26 million people, but it's a very large country, but it's mostly desert, that would invite several hundred thousands, if not more, into their country. They don't want any of them. They don't want any of them because they perceive it as a direct threat to their regime for the simple reason they know, as many Americans know, a small percentage of those refugees will be jihadists, Islamic jihadists, fanatics. Jihad means struggle, and it has different meanings. But in terms of the Islamic State meaning, it's a struggle, a militant struggle against non-believers in Islam, their version of Islam, or infidels. They're different names, but what they're saying is, if you don't believe in our religion, we don't want you here. So Saudi Arabia and its royal family feel very much threatened by the Islamic State, even though early on people in that country were funding it privately, not the country. And that's one of the problems. You don't know what's going on. Putin is claiming, and I think he's largely right, all of these groups are mercenary in the sense that whoever pays them the more money, they'll side with. That is partially true. Not completely, but partially. You offer them more money, they will fight for you. Whether you can trust them and whether they will continue to do it is another matter. So given the fact that Europe today faces an invasion of over a million, 1.3 million, 1.5 million, no one knows the exact number, and now the people of these nations are more than complaining. They don't want these numbers of people to be living in their community, because they don't want to have in their community, in their nation, what happened in Paris. And even if it's 1% or less of these refugees happen to be Islamic jihadists, terrorists of the Islamic State, that's still a lot of people, hundreds if not thousands, depending on what percentage are infiltrating into their country. So why good intentions of welcoming immigrants from other nations is all well and good. The people that vote these politicians in, whether they're in the United States, Germany, France, are going to get, to varying degrees, pushback from the people. There's going to be a reaction, a backlash. We don't want any more immigrants, refugees, to come into the country. They threaten the security and the lives and the property of the people that were born, raised, and educated there. That is happening as I speak. At first, my reaction was, much like Governor Abbott, we don't want any Syrian refugees. Now, Obama tried to, Obama likes to use straw men. In other words, no one is saying that there should be a religious test, but that's what Obama was trying to say. It was contrary to our values to have a religious test. Well, no one is arguing that there should be a religious test. But the fact is, Christians are not members of the Islamic State. Shia Muslims are not members of the Islamic State. The only people that are members of the Islamic State are Arab, Sunni, Salafist, and the militant version of it. So even why most of the refugees are not fanatics, are not infiltrating, in other words, they are fleeing the Islamic State, we don't know who are the good guys and who are the bad guys. It comes right down to that, and what percentage. Let's say it was 1%. If you let in 100,000, that means 1,000 religious fanatics would enter as well. It could be a lot more. It could be a lot less. If it were just a tenth of 1%, it would be 100. And it looks like a group of about 12 people were responsible for the deaths of 129 people, a small group. In other words, they killed about, let's assume for a moment, we don't know the exact size of this group, but let's say it's a squad or roughly 12 people. They had people providing support and people that got away. And right now, the French primarily are trying to track this down. They roughly killed about 10 to 1 and terrorized France. We had a soccer game that was going to be played between Germany and Netherlands that was canceled because the German Federal Republic got information that there was a strong possibility that there would be a bombing at that stadium. You see, that's one of the results of terrorism. They're trying to instill fear in the general public so they don't do what they normally do, whether it's a sporting event, going to a restaurant, going to a concert. Just going about your business is risky. And they have threatened to have an attack in the United States, and specifically in Washington, D.C. So what the House Speaker is demanding from this administration is that they pursue a new strategy, a strategy not of containment, but of destruction of the Islamic State. Now, I said on yesterday's show, and I repeat it, to a limited extent, I agree with Barack Obama. I don't want to see the phrase used is boots on the ground. In other words, I don't want to see large numbers of infantry, combat troops, reintroduce either into Iraq or Syria. There's no good side. That's the point. It's like trying to pick winners and losers in industry. That doesn't work out very well either. And as a result, the American people's hard-earned tax money is wasted. But the same applies in foreign affairs, where most of the people making decisions, they don't know the language, they don't know the culture, they don't understand the religion and the history, and then they're going to try to pick winners and losers. It hasn't worked out too good, because what happens is you pick the wrong people. Sometimes you get lucky, but most of the time you don't. That's what happened in Iraq several times. And the people that you pick are going to be under pressure from their political base in the country. Because when roughly two-thirds of the population in Iraq is Shia, it's going to be difficult to get the confidence of the Sunnis, because they've seen what Shia Iraqi, the militia, has done in terrorizing their own communities. You see, Iraq needs to be split up into those areas that are predominantly Sunni, those areas that are predominantly Shia, and those areas that are primarily Kurd. Those are the three religious ethnic groups. Most of the oil, not all of it, is in southern Iraq where the Shia are. There is some oil in northern Iraq in both Mosul. There's another town, and again, the name of the city escapes me, that the Kurds control. I bring up oil because that is the really only national interest, as far as I'm concerned, that the United States has in the Middle East, and supporting those countries that are producing oil. That's why we are the ally of Saudi Arabia and have been for roughly 70 years. Oil. You have to focus in on that because follow the money. And if you follow the money, where's the money? Why are nations interested in this area? It's largely sand. I'm grossly exaggerating. There are some farmland, I understand, especially along the rivers. But the reason why Western Europe and the United States and the United Kingdom have been interested in the area for over 100 years is simply the oil. They need it to fuel our ships, fly our planes, and be able to drive our vehicle. Now, the U.S. is fortunate enough to not be that dependent upon Middle Eastern oil. As a matter of fact, that's dramatically gone down, but that's not always been the situation. But you need to remind everyone, even I have to occasionally remind me, well, why are we concerned about this area at all? It's oil and, to a lesser extent, natural gas. There are other mineral resources, but that's the primary reason. There's an awful lot of oil in Saudi Arabia, Iraq, and Iran. And Iran also has a lot of natural gas. And yes, why the prices of those commodities have gone down, they fluctuate quite a bit. And where you have a disruption from, for example, if you ever have a disruption from Saudi Arabia, which is a distinct possibility, what do you think is going to happen? Overnight, oil prices will spike, and that can definitely affect the economies of Western Europe as well as the United States. So I won't keep you in suspense anymore. And this is my idea. Do I think it's going to happen? To be brutally honest, no. But what do we need? And what should happen? The Islamic State needs to be destroyed. I agree with the goal. Let me make very, very clear. I agree with the goal very much. But who is going to do that? The army or the force that needs to do that has to be the Sunnis. It has to be people from that area and our allies, Saudi Arabia, Jordan, and Turkey, as well as Egypt, because Egypt is the most populous country in the area. I think it's about 75 million. I know I'm off because it's been a while since I've looked, but that's a good ballpark figure. It needs to be Sunnis that have the military forces in Egypt, Saudi Arabia, Jordan, and Turkey have the military forces. Both troops, Air Force assets, tanks, they need to destroy the Islamic State. And they need to replace it with a Sunni government that has military forces to defend those portions of Iraq and Syria where the Sunnis are. The problem is most of the resistance, both in Syria and Iraq, are either the Islamic State, and remember that one time they were part of al-Qaeda. They had a split with al-Qaeda. And al-Nusra, which is al-Qaeda in Syria. Very effective force that is trying to overthrow the Assad regime, but al-Nusra is also now in conflict with the Islamic State. That's what I say. You need a scorecard here and to figure out what the alliances are. The immediate problem today is where do we send, or who will accept, is probably a better question, the Syrian refugees, knowing that a small percentage, hopefully a small percentage, are affiliated or some way associated with the Islamic State. In other words, we don't want to bring the Islamic State or welcome people that are sympathetic and loyal to the Islamic State into your country, no matter whether it's in Europe or the United States. Many countries are, including Saudi Arabia, but many European countries are simply saying, we don't want them here. Our borders are closed. And part of the reason is money. It costs money to provide and support these refugees. They don't understand the language. They don't understand the customs. They need to find a job, but until they do, they need a roof over their head. They need food, medical services, as well as police services to secure the neighborhood or the location where they're at. All of that costs money, and some of these nations simply are not in the position to fund it, and their people simply don't want to fund it. I need to emphasize this because it's forgotten that all of these nations are welfare states, as is the United States, and are facing serious fiscal problems, just like the United States is. So why the numbers of a million or more are not insurmountable, it will be a burden on the people of any nation that allows them to immigrate as refugees, and that's what they are. They're immigrants, legal immigrants, emphasizing legal here, that are fleeing their native country, largely Syria, not necessarily entirely. I'm sure some are from Iraq, and there's some from other nations that are using this to immigrate into another country that has a better, well, better prospects, better opportunities first to get a job, but until they get a job, be supported by welfare as well as being able to educate their children and get medical attention. All of that costs money. And Speaker Ryan, Paul Ryan, has made it clear, and they're reacting to pressure from their congressional districts as well as states that simply want immigration law enforced, and it's not being enforced. And on top of that, you want to allow 100,000 Syrian refugees, and that's initially coming into this country. The majority of American people are saying no to that. Now, there are many good-intentioned people that would like to welcome them. I understand that. But I know the question that's running through their minds. Are we inviting a terrorist that maybe a year from now or 3 years from now or 5 years from now, they're sleepers, and then suddenly they're activated and start killing people in my community? That's the fear, and I think it's a legitimate concern and fear. So what can we do? I don't want them in the country. I think it's a definite risk, and I think the solution is you want to have in Syria and Iraq a stable situation where most, if not all of these people could at some future date, now in the distant, very much distant future, go back to their country. I think that's the ideal situation. And I think most of these refugees right now, if they could, would like to go back. But they know what awaits them. You don't want to be in the middle of a civil war, because most likely you and your family, your loved ones, will be killed. You don't want to be in a battle between two groups that are very, very violent, that are out to destroy each other. You don't want to be in Syria, and you don't want to be in Iraq. Yeah, there are places in Iraq and Syria that are safe, but you got to be very, very careful. And if you don't watch your step, you can wander right into an area that is either in the enemy's hands or you could be picked out and killed. So my compromise is this. We have a base, a naval base. We have many naval bases, and it's been in the news quite a bit. That's Gitmo, Guantanamo Bay, in Cuba, that we've leased from Cuba, where we could put at least 100,000, probably several hundred thousand. It's not going to be cheap, folks. Because that means men, women, and children are going to have to be taken care of. That's what you're taking on. Providing these people with meals, homes, or a roof over their heads, medical needs being answered, as well as educational needs. We're talking probably at least $1 billion or more. Is it doable? Yes. Will the American people accept it? Probably reluctantly. But what's the advantage? They're not in your community. They're not in the United States. They're on an island. Now, Cuba is not going to be very happy if we suddenly allow, let's use a round number, 100,000 in. And if you've been seeing the television video clips on YouTube or watching the news, many of you observed, I have observed, that many of these people seem to be young males between 18 and 30, not with family. And that's the situation. There are families and children in the refugees. There's no doubt about that. But in terms of the visuals that you see on the news, A large percentage are males fleeing their countries, many because they don't want to be forced or to join one side or the other and join in the civil war. They're fleeing their country, and they're looking for jobs, and they're largely male. Not all of them, but a significant number are. Now, what am I leading up to? Where do these people want to go? The majority. They want to go home. Most of them have homes, and until the civil war started, and it's been going on for years, they were relatively happy. They want to go home where people speak the same language, have the same customs, know the history, and they want to live in peace with their neighbors, even if the neighbors are of a different ethnic group or religion. That is the ideal solution. Will it ever happen? I don't know. I don't have a crystal ball here. But what would it take for that to happen? And remember, most are Sunni. Well, given the fact that we have a Navy base there, we can, over time, train these people. The young men, as well as some young women, but primarily men, can be trained to fight for their country. In other words, go through basic training and then combat training. In other words, become a military force. Now, I don't know how many young men could and would take us up on that opportunity. The idea is to form a new, and I emphasize new, free Syrian army. Forget about the old Free Syrian Army, because frankly, it doesn't really exist anymore. One of the advantages is we can vet these people. In other words, check out their background. And as we're training them, we can observe them. And we will be building, over a period of a year, maybe 2 years, a significant military force. I don't know how many. A division in the Army today is anywhere from 10 to 15,000. That's the U.S. Army. It's going to vary from country to country. My ballpark guess is you could probably get up to four divisions, in other words, anywhere from 40 to 60,000 people, and train them to be a very effective military force. And at some future dates, use transport planes to take them back to Syria and then overthrow the Assad regime and destroy the Islamic State. We're talking probably realistically 2 years, maybe three, but it's doable if you have a leader that's willing to do it. And there, ladies and gentlemen, we have the rub. Barack Obama right now is a lame duck president. He likes to play basketball. I used to play basketball myself. He's trying to run out the clock. You're not going to see any bold initiatives out of him, especially in the area of foreign affairs. But it would satisfy a number of constraints that we have. The American people do not want U.S. military forces in any major way reintroduced to the Middle East. We wouldn't be doing it. Yes, we'd be training these forces, but they are natives of Syria. Some will probably be natives of Iraq, and they will be Sunnis. And they will understand from the very beginning that they're being provided this military training, not so they could get U.S. citizenship, because that is not going to happen. They will, at some future date, be sent back to Syria to be the military of Syria and portions of Iraq. So you'd have at least two or three divisions that are predominantly Syrian and probably a division that are, again, they're all Sunnis, but because this is a very fluid situation, come from northern Iraq. Will this happen? Probably not. Why? There's no leadership. There is no leadership. Now, I'm a non-interventionist. I don't really want the United States in any way, shape, or form intervening in the Middle East. We have more than enough energy, oil, coal, natural gas, uranium in the United States to be energy independent if we want it and really export oil and the products that you can produce from oil. But we do have allies in the Middle East that are counting on it and are definitely threatened by the Islamic State as well as Iran. You see, the problem is not only does the president not have leadership, more and more people are concluding he has sided with the Islamic Republic of Iran. In other words, the Persians and the Shiites. And Iran, and this is what you need to think about, Iran wants to be the dominant power in the Middle East. And over long periods of history, they were. The people that they threaten most are the Sunnis, the Arabs, both in Saudi Arabia, Jordan, as well as in Egypt and Turkey. What we're looking at is a balance of power situation. Another wrinkle is Turkey, though an ally of us, doesn't want the Kurds in their country, as well as in Iraq and a little bit in Iran, to form their own country. See, one of the problems is the Kurds don't have their own country. And they have been fighting the Islamic State, but they've also been fighting Turkey. We definitely need to form a new country. Not us, but advocate for the establishment of a nation for the Kurds. What I'm proposing is we do allow refugees into Guantanamo Bay with the understanding that a significant majority of them will be entering the army, be trained as soldiers, with the understanding not that they're going to be part of the United States Army, but what they will be is a military force that will go back to their native countries and be the core of a fighting force. Now, will that turn out good or bad? I have no idea. Right now, there are no good sides to pick, whether it's the Syrian Civil War or the Iraq Civil War. And yes, this is picking sides, no doubt about it. But the advantage of this approach is we control it. We're going to have to pay for it. We're going to have to control it to the extent it's at Gitmo or on this naval base. It's a large base, by the way. There's plenty of land there to do this. And what you're basically doing is providing basic training, infantry training, as well as special training for combat and combat in cities. And you're probably going to total, probably the target would be about 50,000, maybe 60,000. In other words, about half of the refugees that you allow in. You should allow families as well. But you need to address the fact that a lot of these refugees are young men. They need to be usefully employed. And it would solve, to a limited extent, the problem the United States has today, both in Iraq and Syria. There's not a good side to pick from. So try to build this force and then reintroduce it to Syria. Is it picking sides? You better believe it's picking sides. But today, if this is not a valid or viable option, then I get back to the key point. There's no good sides to pick from. There's really no strategy that's going to be a winner. But the pressing problem is the Islamic State needs to be destroyed. And if we're not going to use U.S. military personnel, which I think would be a very bad idea, either this force or the military forces of Turkey, Saudi Arabia, Jordan, and Egypt have to be used. And the Iranian Republic does not want that. They do not want a strong military presence, both in Syria and Iraq, of a Sunni military force. Yes, that would balance and would have the effect of, or at least a start towards, a balance of power in the area, but that's not what the Islamic Republic of Iran wants. And that's really the second problem. Obama is siding with Iran. He has picked a side. It's Iran, folks. It is Iran, or the Islamic Republic of Iran. He should have sided with the Iranian people, not their oppressors, the mullahs, that are oppressing the people of Iran. And now, because of that treaty with them, we would be sending tens of billions of dollars to Iran so they can engage in more terrorism. Remember, this is the attack of Sunnis, the Islamic State. What do you think is going to happen when Iran gets a nuclear weapon? I want you to think about that. We need to have some semblance of a balance of power in the Middle East. It is getting entirely unstable, chaotic. Our allies legitimately feel threatened by the Islamic Republic of Iran. That includes Israel. It includes Jordan. It includes Turkey. It includes Saudi Arabia, as well as Egypt. You see, more and more people are becoming very, very suspicious as to the loyalties of Barack Obama. It's hard to understand where he's going, what his strategy. He likes to say he leads from behind. You have to be very patient. And where I agree with him, the people in the area have to stand up. That's where I agree with him. But there's no leadership to provide a core capability of standing up. If we trained 1, 2, 3, 4 divisions, well-trained by our own military forces in Guantanamo Bay, that would be the core of a new, free Syrian army. And that's what I'm proposing. And yes, there will be a lot of neoconservatives that would support that. I reluctantly suggest this and support it. But I've wrestled with this, and other than staying completely out of it, there are not many good options here. Some would say there are no good options. We must stop the Islamic State, but we must not use our own army, marine troops to destroy the Islamic State. We can provide the air support. We could dramatically increase the bombings of the Islamic State. But there's one last key point, and I think this is very, very important. What does the United States Constitution say? Congress needs to be involved, but if we're going to go this route and spend this money and get committed to it, the American people have to be committed to it, and that means a declaration of war. And if you're not willing to take that step and get the support of the American people, then stay out. Stay out. See, I take the U.S. Constitution very seriously. And when you're at war with a country, I think it's very important, as did the founders of this country. That's why they put in the Constitution. It's up to Congress to declare war. Presidents can ask. And see, that's the third problem. Our president is not going to ask for a declaration of war. So I think it's a good idea, an interesting idea. Will it happen? Probably not. But it's worth discussing, because right now there are no easy answers. There's no strategy, as far as I'm concerned. There's no leadership. And if we don't do something, it's just going to get worse. You see, there's a great temptation, and Donald Trump is a good example of that. Go in and bomb them, or have the Russians bomb them. Yeah, you can destroy their oil, but who wants that oil? Syria wants that oil. Turkey wants that oil. And yes, that's where the Islamic State gets much of its revenue to support its activity. You see, you always got to get back to the national interest. But until we have a new president that is willing to lead, in other words, he's not a follower, nothing much is going to happen, nothing much is going to change. Because what you have to remember, most of the people in Congress, in the House and the Senate, are not leaders. They're not. They're followers. They're looking for a leader. And we're going to have to wait for over a year until we have a leader. And then it's his problem. And that's my point. Barack Obama is just running out the clock. He's out of ideas. He's becoming less and less popular. He never was and never will be a leader. He's a follower, like most senators, as well as most of our representatives. So leadership is key, and that's why this next election is rather important. With that, I'll close the show with America the Beautiful. My name is Raymond Thomas Pronk, the presenter of the Pronk Pop Show. Views expressed on this show are my own, unless otherwise stated, and do not reflect the opinion of KDUX Web Radio, Richland College, or the Dallas County Community College District. You are listening to KDUX Web Radio, broadcasting live from Richland College in Dallas, Texas. We're the voice of Richland College. You are listening to the Pronk Pop Show, presented by Raymond Thomas Pronk, the People's Paladin Pronk, propagating faith, family, friends, freedom, first. Broadcasted by Renaissance Radio, Radiating Reason, and KDUX Web Radio. Podcasted by PronkPops.wordpress.com and KDUX Web Radio.wordpress.com.